I'm Stargate Pioneer from Voices of Defiance, a podcast member of the Gunna Geek Network, just like the one you're listening to now. The opinions expressed are those of each individual. Check out all the other podcasts at GunnaGeekNetwork.com and get ready, because geekness begins in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything Doctor Who. Join us each week for discussion ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi. I'm your host, Jay Witten.
I'm Ron Burgundy.
And my co-host, Haley Malley.
I am a ray of sunshine.
And Keir Hansen.
Flashy lights, Christmas, woo!
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But don't worry, if we get into anything too serious, we'll warn you again. Welcome to episode 139 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where Kieran and I decide to get some revenge and put all the work on Haley while the two of us sit back with an assortment of alcoholic sampler bottles and live vicariously through her live recordings and memories of hangovers recently passed.
Cheers.
I am Jay, and with me in the GPR studios this week is Kier. How's it going, Kier?
Working on anti-sobriety as we speak.
Awesome. And freshly returned from her trip to Dallas is Haley. How are you doing tonight?
You know, it's been a week, and I think I'm finally sobering up.
Tag.
But this week, we recap my recent weekend in Dallas at the Fan Expo, where I was fortunate enough to hear from Whovian icons such as Billy Piper, Karen Gillan, and Sylvester McCoy.
Excellent. Among a lot of other
bunch of other stuff.
Scope, but
this one wasn't a Doctor Who-centric con, so...
But yeah, you'd be surprised by the talent line that they had, and that's no small shakes for a one-city con. Well, like
it's better than we got at Gallifrey last year, so.
Matt Smith was supposed to be there, and he had to cancel. Like, I think in the last week he canceled.
That sucks.
That would have made for some goofy photo shoots.
Oh, yeah.
So you've got Smith, Gillan, Piper, McCoy wandering around in the background just wanting to photobomb every shot he sees.
I'd like to get one with the Karen Gillan and Matt Smith up front, and then like McCoy in the background trying to get into the shot, you know.
Being hauled off by security,
jumping up and down trying to get seen over their shoulders or something.
I was in The Hobbit. Maybe you've heard of it.
Little film.
All right, so yeah, Haley did record some audio from the panel, so we're gonna go ahead and play those for you now, so that you can hear some of the excitement that happened this weekend.
So, in that one Doctor Who episode, Beast Below, how did you feel covered in all that slimy stuff?
Can I tell you? There was real cabbage in that slime. Like, real cabbage. Food. Vegetable. So that was really weird, and at first it was really fun, because it felt like we were on a sort of ride or something at a fairground. We were like, woohoo, we get to do this for a living, and then maybe 2 hours in, we were like, this is disgusting. And like, we were falling over all the time, and we stank of cabbage, so... But it was fun for a while.
Hi, I just wanted to ask, whenever you were doing Doctor Who, was there anything like that genuinely scared you that was like a prop or something like that without any special effects?
So the silence really scared me, and they were not really CGI or anything. That was a really tall guy in a suit with the weird finger, and that was really intimidating to be around. They're just sort of horrible looking. But like in these sort of like dapper suits, which is quite weird and elegant. I don't know. They were freaky.
In The Girl Who Waited, you had like a couple of really emotional scenes that you had to play with yourself. How difficult was that?
It's really weird acting with yourself. It's bizarre because the best thing about acting, for me anyway, is reacting off what somebody else has given me. So when nobody's giving you anything, that's quite bizarre. Just had to imagine what I was going to do with the other side. We had a double in with like this ginger wig on, but that really wasn't the same. it was really strange, but a cool experience. I would do it again.
I just wanted to say, the master has turned into a girl recently, but how did you feel about that?
Turned into a what?
A woman. The master's turned into a woman.
Wait, who's the woman?
Michelle Gomez.
Are you serious? Wait, what?
Yeah. Spoilers, sweetie. It was speculated that it might be a different character, like it might be the Ronnie, or it might be one of those other nemeses from Doctor's Past, but it winds up being Missy is, of course, feminine for master, for mistress.
Whoa! Okay, I love that. I think that's brilliant. I think the master should be a woman. Let's see what she has to bring. Yeah.
Well, it also opens the door, because if you can have a female master, that means the Time Lords can, we already know that they can switch genders, which means,
maybe,
opens the door,
whoa,
a female doctor down
there. I mean, who would that be? who could play the female doctor? What about Gillian Anderson? I saw her earlier. What a ginger, really good.
I'll always say Helen Mirren. I will always
beat
that
one. Yeah.
You watch her in Red, she's running a 50 cal machine gun like nobody's business.
She could operate
sonic hardest. Screwdrivers, nothing for that.
Yes, you're totally right. It's Helen Mirren.
Hi, my name is Myra.
Hello.
My question is, what made you come back from Matt Smith's regeneration?
Why did I come back? Because Stephen Moffat asked me to. I was like, yes, before he had even finished talking. I was really, really excited. I mean, I knew that Matt was going to be regenerating, and I knew it was going to be a really special moment in Doctor Who history. So I just couldn't believe that I got to be a part of it. But it was so weird going back onto somebody else's TARDIS. I was like, don't like this. Don't like what you've done with the place. It was so weird. Then I came down the stairs. But yeah, it was really fun. It's good. It was sad that day, though. That day was so sad, actually. Gosh, because Matt was, you know, obviously in a weird place because he was regenerating and it was really sad. Jenna was crying the entire day, and I was like, do you need anything? A cup of tea? And I felt like I was the one holding it together. And then Matt finished filming and like walked out of the studio, and I think I was just hanging around the monitors or something, and then the door opens again, and it was dark inside and light outside, and I just see this big silhouette coming to the door, and I was like, could it be? It's him! And it was Capaldi! And oh my god, he like walked in, and he was the doctor all of a sudden, and I was like, whoa, one in, one out! It really is like that! Like in the space of an hour or something, it was crazy!
Did they shoot that in sequence? Because most TV shows at the end, they shoot it
it's
out of sequence.
Way out of sequence, yeah.
So was that actually Matt's final day on set, or did he have other stuff to shoot?
I don't think it was his final day on set, but they did shoot Matt's exit and then Capaldi's entrance in chronological order. So that's why both doctors were in the vicinity. It was so bizarre.
React when you found out that you were going to play River's mom.
Oh, yeah. That was a weird piece of information. I didn't see that one coming. I had no idea. We were all coming up with theories as to who River Song was. I was like, I know who it is, but it wasn't. And then I read the script and I really couldn't believe it. I was so shocked. But at the same time, I was really excited because Amy got to be so integral to the storyline of the whole thing, and that made me really happy. And then I was like, oh, we're going to have so much fun playing this mother-daughter relationship from now on. Alex Kingston knew the whole time, but of course, playing River, she didn't say anything.
Her hair is just full of secrets.
Yeah. It's full of spoilers.
God, never mind. When you're making the transition, it's weird to retire from something before age 20, but that was when you had the opportunity to do. You said, I'm done with music, I'm focusing on the stage career. You are already voted the face of the generation, just a phenomenal thing. And then, after that, Russell T. Davies is starting to cast for Doctor Who. Talk a little bit about the process on, because they're rebooting the series, it hadn't been on the air for over a decade,
right?
But it's still a British and really a global phenomenon, even before the reboot hit. So talk a little bit about how they approached you and how you were brought into the production.
It was really kind of a straightforward sort of procedure that I was used to, which was get the script. I read the script. I didn't really understand anything at this point about Doctor Who. I didn't watch it as a child, so I'm glad in a way, because I think I would have been slightly overwhelmed by that responsibility had I have known what I was about to embark on. But fortunately, I read it, and beyond the sort of sci-fi stuff, I just connected to Rose, because I thought, you know, here is this kind of fronted young girl from Council Estate who is headstrong and, you know, curious and sort of bored of her life as it is, and I sort of understand those things. And so I went into the audition. I was really sick that day. I remember, like, scoffing a brownie just before the audition, and went in. Russell was there, sunshine as ever, with Julie Gardner, another bean, and I just, my version of what I thought Rose was, and they were very clapping. They clap a lot, those guys. And that was really thrilling. And then I left, and I got a little to do a reading of it with Chris, which we did at the BBC in a horrible room. but it went well, and I got the ball. And then I started freaking out.
At that point, though, there's still a little bit of trepidation because it's a new generation, it's a new series, it's a new book. What was the feeling on the set? Did you know that you had hit at that point, or was everybody still on pins and needles because they don't know how it's going to be received?
I think Russell and Julie and Phil at the helm were confident, but I don't think any of us, we didn't really know what we were doing, and a lot of the things being done for the first time, or certainly for the actors and working with green screen, and for me, I hadn't done any of those things, filming through the night. I mean, that just seems bold to me, but I got used to that, and I had to, because a lot of those filmed in the evening. But anyway, it was just, I think we were all a bit tentative about the outcome. Meanwhile, there's loads of, like, you know, Doctor hate, like, you know, people who've been cast. There was a lot of, you know, I've noticed something about Who, which is they don't like change. Initially, and then, like me, they seem to sort of sail through with the next round of pop. So, you know, I understand that. it's something we share. But I felt tense about that. Thank God we didn't have a Twitter, and I wasn't really online and looked up in my life, because I would have been frightened by it. And what was being said, I heard. Anyway, fortunately.
How were you given the news that they were making, that the changes were being made between Chris Eccleston and David Tennant?
Oh, it's just one of those, Billy, we need to speak to you. Okay, coming to this office, sure. yeah.
Headmaster wants to speak to you.
Yeah, come in here, we need to talk to you about stuff. Okay, Chris is leaving, and I was like, okay, well, I'm leaving then. I can't really do this alone, and we've been through so much together, this seems ridiculous. And they were like, me, David Tennant, we think you're going to like him. And I was like, no, I'm not interested. It's over for me. You've ruined my life. and I have to be loyal to Chris. This is an outrage. And then I met David and I was like, oh, everything's fine. That's what I mean about being, you know, a superficial Whovian. No, I'm joking. But I sort of sailed seamlessly from one man to another, one alien to another.
Oh dear.
What have I done here today?
It's okay. Nobody has the ability to transmit to the internet here at all.
There's no one watching, which is a relief.
Oh, no. Yeah, it's just you and me up here. So. Oh, my goodness. What do we have now? Hi, guys.
It's you. Whoa. Oh, love.
Mr. Rose?
Yes?
What's your favorite Avenger?
Favorite?
Which is Avenger?
favorite adventure? Avenger. Sorry, I'm confused.
What was your favorite adventure?
What was my favorite adventure? I really love Tooth and Claw as an adventure. Just because it was so funny to film, and the whole thing as a concept I found really lively and, I don't know. I just think we laughed so much filming that. So I really enjoyed that adventure. I also enjoyed the adventure of meeting my dad again, although that was pretty sad too.
First again, Sylvester, it is an honor to have you on our stage. Thank you very much for coming out to Fan Expo Dallas, and thank you very much for just being a part of a great celebration of a program that, you know, as a 29-year-old actor, it has to be amazing for you to be a part of that and have that as a member of your legacy.
Am I 29? Ooh, that jet lag really is bad. Yeah. No, I was 27 when I got the part. No, I wasn't. What were you trying to go? No, I was 40-odds when I got the part. I look 29.
Phenomenal.
And facelifts are good in those days.
I'm a little sad, though, that I don't see any spoon.
Oh. Anybody get any spoons?
Did anybody bring spoons for Sylvester? Because as a youth coming up through both stage and on television, you made your living as a busker. And that's how you basically gained notoriety and caught the eye of a casting agent, if I remember the story correctly. Am I getting that completely wrong because Wikipedia lies about everything?
I don't know. Yes, I mean, I did busk. We started off busking, and then we started working, busking inside theatres as well as outside. I busked outside Joan Littlewood's theatre. She was one of the greatest British directors of the 20th century, and she came out and used to throw money at us, and then one day it was raining and she brought us onto the stage and eventually employed me as an actor on the stage. So, yes, I came from busking into theatre and then I kind of carried on through. And, someone who'd seen the roadshow busking gave me a job on television in a piece called Vision On, which was a very visual piece of television that was hugely successful in Britain. Did well in Canada too, but America didn't. I don't think it was seen in America. Yeah.
I don't think it had a distribution deal. That's why it didn't do well, because it wasn't playing here. That is an absolute falsification, sir. It does not have to play here. You can have success. But it's not for you lack of trying. If I remember correctly, one of the segments involved you setting your head on fire.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, what happened was that I was mistaken, if you can say that word, for an actor. I was working in the Roundhouse box office, and there was another actor collecting my tickets because his wife was part of the administration. So Brian Murphy used to collect the tickets when he wasn't working. He'd come hang around, and he'd collect the tickets I sold, and he somehow thought I was an actor. And then a director came in one day called Ken Campbell and said to him, "Hey, Brian, I've got this mad show. Someone's let me down, young actor. I need someone. Do you know anyone?" And Brian said, "That's the guy in the box office. He's out of his head." So he came up and he said, "Do you want to join my show?" And I said, "Yes." Because I have always had the inability to say no. Very good reason. I'm not a lady. It's been terrible. Anyway, so I became an actor. No idea what I was. I just said yes. And so I became an actor. And then we created Sylvester McCoy. Because my name was Kent Smith, and I acted with them for a little bit in sketches. Then we went and joined the circus for a little while. And then when we left the circus, I said to Ken, "We should take the skills we learned in the circus, use them in the roadshow, go on the street," because we used to play pubs and recommend clubs and small theatres, and, you know, just generally have a good time. And on the street, and so we started doing stunts. And Ken Campbell came up with the name Sylvester McCoy. The name Sylvester came from a song, the First World War song. It came from America. It was about the first, black soldiers who came across, brave and wonderful men that they were, to help Brits, considering we started slavery, and that was amazing of them to forgive us and come across and try and save us. Anyway, they did. And the song was, Have you heard about the big strong man who lives in a caravan? Have you heard about the Jeffrey Johnson fight where that great black American beat the night? You can bring all the heavyweights you got, cause we got a little man to play the lot. He plays the organ and the belfry, and he wants to fight Jack Dempsey. That's my brother, Sylvester. What's he got? He's got a roll of 40 medals on his chest, big chest. Explored all the Arctic in his vest. He knows no rest. Big of the arm, strong of a punch, hellfire, son of a gun. Don't push, just shout, plenty of the room for thee and me. He's got an arm as big as a leg, a lady's leg, and a punch that's in the battleship, big ship. It takes all the army and the navy to put the wind up. Sylvester. That's where my first name came from. And I can't tell you the second one because there are children in the room. Anyway, we created this character, An Evening with Sylvester McCoy, the Human Bomb. Now, nowadays, that doesn't go down well. But when we started it, it was a big hit. We became a cult and we travelled all over Europe. We even went to Israel. And I was the Human Bomb in Israel. We used to take them out in the audience. You see, we'd be in the theatre and we'd do all sorts of stunts. And they announced that Sylvester McCoy will now explode a bomb in his chest. But we can't do it in the theatre. So, ladies and gentlemen, get and stand up. And then we'd march the whole audience out into the street, into a car park or a bomb site or somewhere. And then I'd lie down on the ground and I'd put a bomb in my chest and they'd light it and it would explode. And then if the audience behaved themselves, I'd set light to my head. And that's why I started setting light to my head. I'd blow fire as well, as you do. What you do. It's one way, one route towards the Royal Shakespeare Company. But anyway, I was a stuntman. I did every stunt. I was a skinny little fella. And the idea was I banged nails up my nose, I put threads down my trousers to try and break the world record, I escaped from mailbags, handcuffs, I was handcuffed, I used to meditate a piece of cotton wool and then burst into fire, I could levitate people, there's all sorts of things. I did stunt after stunt after stunt, but it was a very witty show because the director, Ken Campbell, was a bit of a comic genius. And he wrote some amazing dialogue to go with it. I'm incredibly proud. That's how I really started off my career. But nowadays, you know, if I advertise an evening with Sylvester McCoy, the Human Bomb, I'd be arrested. And rightly so. I mean, that was a time of innocence. You know, you could do a thing like that, but now it'd just be unthinkable.
Well, it was a great time for British television at that point, too, because you had, you know, you had the Goons, you had Python, you had all of these great troops, you know.
Well, we were pre-Python.
Right.
We were just, and we were unfortunate, really. We did a few TV pilots, because we were quite mad, and, you know, insane, like Python. The Goons obviously inspired us, as did lots of other people, but... we were also, you know, we have a thing in our country called the class system. And sadly, it still exists. And none of us had gone to university. We'd gone through drama school. Whereas the Pythons came along and they'd all gone to university. And they were, you know, God bless them, they're great. I've worked with them since. And I don't knock them for it. But it was just that if we had gone to university, we most likely could have made that step. It was more difficult. Because it was very, very... new stuff. Nobody had ever seen anything quite like it. And, you know, we did it in the theatre. We went to Germany. They called us the Beatles of the theatre in Germany. We got photographs taken from Playboy magazine. With all our clothes on. Anyway.
Did it sell?
That's as good. No, in Germany. They used to ask us, they didn't quite understand why we used to explode bombs in our chest and set light for our head. What is the political reason why you are blowing up your head? Would you say, just for a laugh? What? A laugh? It was also kind of tragic, sad in a way, because when we arrived there in the early 70s, we toured Germany, we played the Deutsche Schauspielhaus, we played the Academy der Kunst in Berlin, I was in Hamburg, we were in Frankfurt, we were all over Germany, and we were a huge success. They hadn't ever seen anything like it. But what was really sad was, although they did ask those questions about the political reason why, partly it was to do with Hitler and the war and the Nazis, because what happened was that they'd wiped out Variety in Germany. Because Variety, it's got gay people in it, it's got, dwarves, it's got, all sorts of, mad people like me. And, they got rid of them. And they actually they cut out a piece of their entertainment. And so when we arrived, a new generation hadn't seen any of that, really. So it was quite interesting. And we brought it back to them, and we showed them, And they could go back and find that they had great German extreme comics, visual comics and stuff like that.
But all the footage was burned at that point, along with a lot of books and the rest of the
culture. They tried to wipe out anything that was funny. But that was because Hitler was funny. And he didn't want anyone around who thought he was funny. So they just weren't funny about it.
I'm curious, and we do have a microphone here, and that guy had this, so... when I said there was a microphone up here, I couldn't move away. I do want to ask one other question. When you were casting for and received the role of Doctor, what was the first thing that went through your mind? As, you've got characters had six incarnations and such esteemed history. What was going through your head as a street performer who was mistaken for an actor, becomes an actor, and gets one of, at the time, world's most iconic?
Nothing. The thing is, you see, when I first saw Doctor Who in 1960s, I remember, it was Patrick Jones. And I saw him. I didn't have a television. But the man downstairs, we lived in this kind of rooming house, a bohemian rooming house. And I supplied the soup, he supplied the telly, and Stella de Quincey supplied the cigarettes and the other bit. And so we used to do the football goals, the football bowl results came out, and then after the football calls, or before them, I can't remember, Doctor Who appeared. And that's how we got into Doctor Who. We weren't really interested in it. We're interested in the results, and, then we started watching. And we became hooked. And so I became a fan of Doctor Who's. We watched it. We looked forward to it a lot every Saturday. And then John Pertwee took over, and then Tom Baker. And halfway through Tom Baker, I became an actor. And therefore, we didn't have any means of recording it, repeated. So it vanished from my life, as it would. Just gone, missed and carried on. I was doing my stuff. Tom Baker can go off and do his stuff, for all I care. Now he's a lovely man. I was joking. No, anyway. I'm lying. I'm just joking. Josh. Anyway, so I become an actor, traveling the world, doing stuff, having a great time. And then I heard that, who was it? I heard that Peter Davidson was leaving. Yeah, and up to that point, people always said to me, you should do Doctor Who. Yeah, I'm great. Like, but they kept saying it, and partly because I always wore my scarf like this. So I always kind of wore a scarf, and somehow the scarf reminds me of Doctor Who. Anyway, so I hear in the news, Peter's leaving, so I phone my agent. There's a job going to the BBC. And he said, they phoned up and said, sorry, we're already cast. And then cut to 2.5 years later, bang, it's on the news again. Colin Baker's leaving. And so I phoned up and said, Colin Baker's leaving. And my agent did get in touch with John Nathan Turner, the producer. And he said, hello, I think you should see Sylvester McCoy. I said, John, it's Sylvester who? And my agent, yes. And so the next call that comes through, John Nathan Turner picks it up. And it's a producer who happened to Vision On and things like that with rather promising years ago. I did loads of television before Doctor Who, but mostly children's television, years and years of it. So anyway, he had produced a lot of my stuff, and he said to John Nathan Turner, I think you should Sylvester McCoy. It'd be good. And John said, wait a minute, I've just spoken to his agent. He said, are you with the same company, agent? No, we don't know what you're talking about. And so this was a great thing. J&T was slightly into, things like that, synchronous, all that kind of thing. So he went, ooh, I mean, I'm interested. And luck would also have it. I was at the National Theatre playing the Pied Piper, a musical play that had been written for me. So I was starring at the National, John came along, and in another bizarre coincidence, I was wearing a multicoloured coat with Colin Baker. A beautiful coat that my character had. But anyway, that didn't seem to... Maybe John is just those kind of coats. Anyway, he went back afterwards to the office and said, because I came along to see him. It was a sunny day, and I wore my straw hat the way I did. I wore the straw hat, and John said, "Oh, that's great. I would love to have that in Doctor Who." And I said, "Well, if the hat's in Doctor Who, I go with it." So that's how I got it. I then had to do screen tests because the people upstairs said, "No, no, he's too light hat, too light weight." And so I did screen tests. John Nathan had to fix it. The other two actors didn't look. So I ended up, I got it. So that's how I got it.
Beautiful. So no. I have a class of students that I teach after school, and we have a Doctor Who club. And we've been watching both new and classic Who. So the thing that's happened is we've watched Survival. It's the first time many of them saw you. And the class is very sharply divided. Half of them really enjoyed it. The other half are saying, "Oh, I don't like this. The special effects aren't good enough. It's too long. It's too difficult to follow." So the question I have for you is, or rather it's just a statement, and you can respond to it because my students are now watching you. Make a retort to their argument about, "Oh, classic Who isn't as good as new," or how would you like to support classic Who, specifically your era?
Wow!
Mind you, these are 7, 8, 9, and 10-year-olds watching this. So.
Now, you guys who like the old stuff, the classic, you guys who hate it, I'm going to haunt you tonight. In the old Who, the classic Who, of time, we can develop character. We can develop character. There was more time to develop the story as well and take it on a journey. The sets shook a bit, quite a lot. But I mean, when our Dalek went up the stairs, that was a real Dalek that went up the stairs, not CGI. It's easy now, just press the button, and there it goes. Really. When our Dalek went up the stairs, I'll tell you what happened. This is the BBC for you. The Dalek, the very first time in the history of the Dalek was up the stairs in one of my remembrances of the Daleks. Now what they do is they get a real Dalek, a big, heavy Dalek. They don't even build a light one. They don't get a cardboard one. They get a heavy one. And they stick scaffolding poles into its side. Boom! Boom! Like that. My goodness, that Dalek screamed. Anyway, they stuck with that. You can imagine. So there's these two poles sticking out much longer than that. And then through the wall, and there's the stairs, and then the Dalek. And then what they did was at the other end, they had a pole parallel to the incline of the stairs. And then on the other side of this pole there, they had 10 men hanging on to the scaffold. And so that's why they got the Dalek up the stairs. They got these 10 men sweating and cursing. This poor Dalek was going, up the stairs. And I'm going, and he's giving this Dalek up the stairs. We had to go up to the top of it. It threw up, I think. But nowadays, just press a button. I think that's boring. My name is better.
Thank you very much. Is there talk about Davidson perhaps making another script for you lot and bringing that troupe back and getting us more of you guys on screen together? Because you heard it. Everybody loved the five-ish Doctors, you know, reuniting on screen again. Is there a possibility that Davidson might have another script rattling around in that brain of his?
Well, I don't know. I mean, he's brilliant. What he did with that was joyful and witty and inventive. Everything, I'm just so full of praise for him for that. And proud to, humbled to be in it. But the problem is, you see, everybody did it for nothing. None of us got paid. We did it for the love of the programme and the love of the fans. Because the fans wanted us to be in the 50s. We realised we weren't. And we, you know, early on, it was going to be a home movie. But then it kind of built up. Because each time Peter asked someone, "Would you like to be in it?" They said, "Yeah, yeah, yeah." And then eventually we got Peter Jackson and Ian McKellen. Well, And then, of course, we even got the BBC involved in some bizarre way. And the producer, who wasn't going to have us in the 50th anniversary, was actually in ours. And while he was filming it, he suddenly realised, wait a minute, I'm the villain of this piece. So it was a joy and a great, I'm glad it's been so well received, and I'm the Hobbit. And, but what could, how could we get someone like Ian McKellen again? It cost us £20 million. We couldn't do a second one without paying people. The only way was to maybe fundraise or whatever it's called. That might be a thing to do. But I suggested that what we could do is we could try and take over, what do you call it, the one, the motor car one?
Top Gear.
I don't know. Here. I mean, Colin, he could be the big grumpy bad temper.
That stretch.
Oh, no, great acting, no bad for that.
Oh, yeah.
I could play the wee dwarf one. Rather handsome, well, you know, and of course, you know, Peter could be the sensible one in the middle.
Sure.
But they didn't jump at that. Although I think it'd be really good because it's quite topical, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway,
so. All right, get the hashtags going, kids. We need to make this happen.
Hello. Good day. Good afternoon. Good evening. Splendid. Hey, listen. I do the comedy here.
Mr. Sylvester McCoy.
Yep.
In your run, what would be your favorite villain?
My reign. I suppose it was the master, really. Yeah. The thing about Anthony Amy is that, well, once he started doing the master, he never wanted to play any other role. All he wanted to do was play cricket and the master. And he was a bit like the master off screen as well as on screen. He used to frighten the life out of me. We were filming Survival, and that's the time when I worked with him. And it was, as I say, it was over 100 degrees Fahrenheit. I had on that big jumper, all that costume. It was unbearably hot. We had a battle, and it was on a stage, and all the way around the stage, there was a good fire, so that increased the heat. And then all the people had been to the opticians to get cat's eyes, you know, cat's lenses, because that was part of the story. And they said I didn't need them. And then on the day we did it, they suddenly said, oh my God, you do need them. So we had to borrow someone else's lenses and stick them in. There was sand everywhere. There was lenses, there was sand, there was that. I was weeping. I couldn't see, and I was hot, and it was uncomfortable. And Anthony Ainley forgot that acting was, he was the master. So he had a big femur in his hand, a big bone, and he was beating the bejabers out of me. And I could hardly see to try and stop him doing it. I said, you know, have you ever heard of acting? Anyway, next story.
All right, so you can tell that there's a lot of fun to be had at these conventions. I know we've talked about it before, and you know, especially with the Doctor Who centric conventions, they're it's built for this kind of thing. But even at the major conventions like this, you're going to get some of the talent, and it's so much fun to go to these panels and hear these stories and you know, hear the kind of questions that other people can come up with to put to the stars.
Mm. Yeah, I know a lot of times when we like to crow about particular cons that we have great experiences with, it's usually a matter of, oh, you know, we went to some of the fan-run panels that really insightful stuff gets discussed because that's what we do. And so we, you know, we kind of enjoy that sort of thing. Or it's the cosplay was just amazing. You know, we try to hit Dragon Con every year, which is just, that's primarily focused on cosplay and that sort of thing. But you have to remember that one of the major draws for these is the primary talent panels and discussions, and when you've got the right combination of people, or people that are really appreciating the fact that they've been invited out for these and they really get into it, it changes, you know, it raises the level of the enjoyment, you know, exponentially. It's not just a Q&A. Now it becomes weird, uncomfortable TMI stories or whatever the case may be. So always something to enjoy.
Yeah. So if you have a chance to make it to any kind of convention, it's well worth the time. It's always a blast. And you're surrounded by people that, you know, one of them is going to pick up on your random obscure reference that you never thought anybody would. So Fun times.
Yeah, I know. Seattle just this past weekend, as we're recording, has just finished up Anglicon. So please, you know, any listeners who got a chance to attend, let us know. Share some photos with us. You know, let us live vicariously through you for a little bit, because that's a little bit of a distance for all three of us, you know, to get out to the SeaTac area. So, and then we've got a couple more that are coming down the pipe. New Orleans has theirs coming up in a three, four weeks, I think. I think it's a late June or a mid-July. And then, you know, and then it just ramps up as we get towards the end of the year, and we've got a lot of stuff happening here on the East Coast too. NYCC for Comic-Con's coming around in October. Mm-hmm. All kinds of weirdness involved with that. I got some very strange invitation emails from some of the promoters down there. Well, for me, it's down there where I am in New England, saying that they're doing things like recreating the Blood Rave from Blade.
Oh, jeez.
And you can actually participate in the reenactment if you want to be in the Blood Rave. So, yes, literally something for everyone. So yeah. The major cons, whatever you're into.
Yeah, just know when you go to the bigger cons like Comic-Cons and things like that, you're going to wait in line for things. You're going to sit through panels you're not particularly interested in. So you've got a good panel for the one that good seat for the panel that comes next. Whereas the smaller cons, you know, you can get in, get out, get to what you want to do. But you're not going to see the big names.
Right, yeah. So that kind of takes us into our first news story here, which apparently Gallifrey One has put out their first guest announcements.
Yeah, just a small list.
And if you were upset by the lack of doctors, or you know, the fact that it was Torchwood basically last year, you're not going to be disappointed this year, because we've got, you know, Peter Davison, Samuel Anderson, you know, Danny Pink, Nicola Bryant, Neve McIntosh. I mean, and the list goes on and on and on, and there's huge names in here.
Yeah, this is just the first wave. They have months and months to go. Mm-hmm. And what will be great to see is when they get opportunities to complete sets, so to speak. So if you've got, you know, Peter Davison, and if they may happen to land, I don't know, one of his working, Nyssa Teigen, you know, mm-hmm. Turlough, who knows, you know, and they create panels. They're very careful about creating panels of interest that involve people that can kind of do the reminiscing stories and things. You know, they'll have Fraser Hines there. So, you know, whoever they sit down with him, you know, he's going to eat their lunch and bury them in anecdotes and so forth. But it's just, you know, the fact that they're going to have Samuel Anderson will be, I think, personally pretty interesting, because we haven't really been able to kind of pick the brain of the Danny Pink character much. Mm-hmm. And we may get some, you know, by that time we'll be all the way through the next season, we'll know whether or not there was any future for Danny's character whatsoever. So, you know, the fact that they're going to keep him in the mix in some of these major cons might be kind of helpful for those of us who are trying to get some additional information. And please, Neve McIntosh, I'm done. The mic drop, moonwalk out of the room. I'm done.
They got to get the rest of the Paternoster game. That's what they need.
They had Dan Starkey there last year.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised to see Starkey show up again. So then it was just be get Jenny there. And, yeah.
Art? I think they could get Caitlin Stewart.
All right. And then the next bit of news that we've got here, apparently a new guest star has been announced for Series 9. It is Rebecca Front. I am not sure. I know she's won a BAFTA. I'm not familiar with the other stuff that she's done, though.
Is it all super British?
Well, no, she was in the thick of it with Peter Capaldi. So if you didn't get a chance to, and I've been trying to, you know, put this into your guys' hands for a little while, she's a great comedic talent. She's got she generally plays kind of I'm not going to say the straight man character, but at least her role within the thick of it, damn near everybody's role in the thick of it that wasn't Peter Capaldi's role, was one that was kind of put upon. So you'd see them in these situations where their political careers were sort of spiraling out of control due to various degrees of ineptitude. But she was really enjoyable. Personally, I had a lot of fun. She came into it about the third season or so. But of course, these are British seasons, so they were only like 6-8 episodes apiece. Right. So,
well, she also played Jenna Coleman's mother in Death Comes to Pemberley.
Oh.
Okay.
Interesting.
Okay.
Yeah, but this article here says that she will be returning in an episode or an adventure that returns the Zygons. So.
Okay.
But they said that her actual role in it is very closely guarded, so we don't know what's going to happen with that. So begin the speculation.
Well, we got Ingrid Oliver back within that same episode. could be mother character that can identify her not as her actual daughter because she doesn't behave properly. Okay. All right. Well, I'll start theorizing.
And then the last bit of news that we've gotten, this isn't really news, but the people over at the Gallifrey Times have put together a solid compilation of all the news that we've got so far from Series 9. Mm-hmm. So if you want to go and dig into the nitty gritty, this is a great spot to start with. They've got everything kind of compiled real nicely. And actually, this is kind of what we're going to be doing next week, actually, because as we're getting close to August, we're hitting that point where Series 9 is actually starting to become a reality and not just this far off dream that it was for so very long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, they're in the final production blocks. They're mm-hmm. they're locking down some of the last episodes that need to get their principal filming done before everything starts going into effects and editing and such. It goes without saying. Big spoiler neon sign blinking over both this link and what we'll be discussing next week. So if you're one of those types, and I know there are a number of you out there because I've spoken actually with a couple of you that don't want to know too much about what's happening in the season to come. You just want the full surprise experience and just it's Christmas Day every day, you know, when a new episode hits. But I personally love just getting just enough information to know who's going to be involved. Who some of the principal creators of the content are going to be, who's in the among the production team mm-hmm. and the direction team. And from there, plot speculation of those things, I'll take it so far and then I'll back away from the table when it starts getting really argumentative. But
So if you want to go and check out the link, you can. If not, come back next week and you'll hear us basically talk about everything that's in it. So
yes. Plus whatever unveils over the next week, because now we're getting to the point where you get, a new interesting little tidbit of information regarding Season 9 every other day or so.
Pretty much, yeah. So, yeah, but that's about it for this week. Hopefully you enjoyed the panels and everything. And again, go to a convention. If there's one close by, make the effort because it is definitely going to be great.
Yeah, you got Chicago TARDIS, you've got New Orleans, you've got Long Island, you got something in pretty much every fragment of the country and overseas. Okay, apparently they do some of these in the UK too. I've heard sort of popular.
Really? They do. They like the show over there?
I think so.
Well,
it's got a small
They took
following.
Our version of it. Yeah, they took our version of it, and they just do it over there verbatim with accents. It's almost as good.
See, we were going to have a really good TV movie, and then they just took it and twisted it, and it's, yeah.
They're like, oh, let's do a long-form television series with it.
Exactly, yeah.
Oh, there's too much snogging.
All right, well, this has been episode 139 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, we're coming up on Series 9, yay!
This is Kier saying, that's not a ferret.
And this is Haley saying, more river!
We'll see you guys next week.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to gunnageek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.gunnageek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2015.